So we don't have a whole lot of time, so we will cover only the first tetrad and a couple more steps of the second tetrad. The first tetrad is the body, and the second tetrad is the feeling tone. And we will end on the sixth step, which is the cultivation of happiness. So it's actually quite uplifting to stop and think about that this training includes cultivation of joy. Thich Nhat Hanh says Buddhism is a very intelligent way of enjoying life. It offers us happiness. Please help yourself. I like this quote very much. So, how wonderful, not to have a training that includes us learning how to incline the mind towards joy and happiness. Now, this discourse builds on a closely related other discourse. We might say that they're sisters. And some of you might know that sister discourse. It's the four foundations of mindfulness, or in Pali is the Satipatthana. And I want to mention because the Satipatthana's contemplations, not only is it divided also in four groups, like the Anapanasati, but the themes of each of these four groups are the same. They share the same themes. So the first one being body, the second one being feeling tone, the third one being the mind, and the fourth one being dhammas, or I like to call it categories of experience. Now, in the sister discourse, the Satipatthana, the one connecting thread through the whole discourse is embodying mindfulness, so embodying sati. In the Anapanasati, the connecting thread is us being continually mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath throughout the 16 steps. Now, in the Satipatthana, it's all about understanding the nature of these four areas of the body, the feeling tone, the mind, and the dhammas. However, in the Anapanasati, it goes beyond that. It builds on this understanding, but it goes much deeper. It is about penetrating and resting in the essence of these four areas. So that's why I wanted to mention this sister discourse, because although they have something in common, this is a more advanced practice that builds on it. So we can say that this discourse, the Anapanasati, is a journey towards more and more refined and subtle states. It does so with a minimum of concepts, as we will see later in the instructions. Now, each of the four tetrads in the Anapanasati has a very specific goal. The goal of the first tetrad in the Anapanasati is calming the bodily activity. Perhaps you felt that a little bit in the guided meditation. And we'll look at that a little bit more closely later. The goal of the second is calming the mental activities. So first the body, then the mind. Then the goal of the third one is about liberating the mind, liberating it specifically from the burden of self, of selfing, as we sometimes say in Dharma circles. And the fourth one is the goal is letting go, which can be synonymous with liberation, but this is liberation with capital L. This is we let go of anything that gets in the way of our being free. So I asked myself at some point, like, if I had to describe with an image what this teaching means to me in its depth and its breadth, what came to me was the image of a great big oak tree. Now, if you visualize, I could see in this image not only the branches, but also the roots. Its roots anchored deep into the earth, and the branches covering a big, big space, offering a beautiful, shady, peaceful area for anybody that comes close to the tree. Now, with this image, we can think that just like with the roots of the oak, this teaching penetrates deep into our inner world. And in our exterior world, our relational world, it extends to cover every relation. So now I want to talk about the setting of this discourse, which I find very telling. It says a lot about the nature of this discourse, how it is described, in what kind of place and situation it takes place. It says a lot that the Buddha offered this teaching during the rainy season, which, as you know, in India happens kind of like around August, October, November. So that's the rainy season. And so the tradition was and still is that during that time, you have a 3 month, what you call the rains retreat. It originally was to avoid walking on the planted fields when the soil was, very damp and loose, and you would damage the harvest. So, but for us, just to what's important is to know that the Buddha chooses to offer this teaching during the longest retreat of the year. That says a lot. And I like to imagine the monks and nuns in this physical seclusion in the monastery, while outside, perhaps it's raining, and they have in the monastery this physical seclusion, and then they cultivate also the mental seclusion. You know, which means when we say mental seclusion, that means you really are trying to keep the unwholesome mind state away and cultivate the wholesome. So this setting of a long retreat and the physical and mental seclusion are the ideal conditions to contemplate this teaching, which, as I mentioned, is considered very advanced and subtle. We need this outward and inward silence to delve into the Anapanasati. So, does it mean that we shouldn't contemplate this discourse if we're not on a long retreat? Of course not, because we can begin by just learning about it, learning as the first level of acquiring wisdom. This is what we're doing now, hearing the teaching, and it can also include reading the Dhamma. Then we go to the next level of acquiring wisdom, and that is reflective contemplation. You know, we can take some time. This is a discursive contemplation. Is how do I relate to this? How do I Yeah, how do I how does it feel to practice? What does it mean to me, this teaching? And the third and most important and really very central for this teaching in particular is the meditative practice. And here, especially with this teaching, we're using a minimum of concepts. And the focus is on our direct experience. So this is the way we will be able to cultivate the Anapanasati teaching. This level requires concentration, whereas the other two, not that much. The meditative practice or the Anapanasati actually tells that we need to cultivate concentration in one of the tetrads. So we are aware that it is in retreat setting that with continuous practice that we can truly begin to experience the depth of this teaching. And we are also aware that a lot of good can also come out just from learning about it and practicing it in our daily life as well. And of course, we have to be a little bit more patient because, as we may be experienced with a guided meditation, from the very beginning, it asks a lot about from us. And we'll see why is it that challenging a little bit later. But back to the setting of this teaching. This discourse, we are told, is delivered during a full moon. And I feel as this darkness underscores the intimacy of the gathering, the darkness functioning as an invitation to turn our attention inward. And I also find very beautiful that the full moon in Buddhism symbolizes a liberated mind. So if we can envision the moon as a source of light that we can actually see directly without hurting our eyes, unlike the sun, the moonlight, as this teaching is being conveyed as the only source of light, can become a source of inspiration, of quietude, of peace, of silence, and reminding us of our capacity to liberate the mind and heart. So now let's delve into the first six steps. That is what we're going to look at. And we'll go first by looking at the first tetrad. And let me see if it works. I've just put it in the chat and I've just sent it to you. So I think it is helpful visually to have the instructions in front of us just to really take in how simple they are, how tremendously naked these instructions are. I mean, it can be disconcerting. They are so sparse. But I invite you to think of them as a map, as an outline of our journey. Let's look at how steps one and two are different from three and four. And they are actually different from all the rest, but you only have till four in the chat. One and two deal exclusively with the breath. They are all about establishing mindfulness firmly on the breath. And also notice that in steps one and two, the instructions are in the present tense. To me, this points at our focusing the attention on the process of breathing. So in steps one and two, I am to be cognizant not only of the in-breath and out-breath, but also of the length of the breath. Perhaps some of you were able to experience that during the guided meditation. When we are focusing on the length of the breath, it requires a very kind of precise, narrow focus, but without any tension. And the focus has to be constant. So with the contemplation of the breath, it will be revealed to us from the most intimate to the most impersonal and universal aspects of our experience. So if you look now at step number three, now it changes. Now, for the first time, we get one trains, and this will repeat in the rest until step 16. We will have this word one trains experiencing. So here it now we are asked to take in the whole body. So starting then with step three, awareness of the in-breath and out-breath will be one of two areas of focus in each step. So in three is the in-breath, out-breath, and the body. So you might remember that I mentioned in the preliminary instructions to focus on the body, but that was just the alignment. We talked about the physical alignment, so the posture. Here, when we now bring the awareness to the body, we are focusing on the energetic quality of the whole body. And also notice that the tense has changed from the present to the future. Now we have I shall. So why? Everything is very precise in this teaching. It has a reason. To me, it's pointing to what we want to do of conditioning the mind. It's part of the instruction to condition the mind to be very aware of these two tracks that will be the in-breath and out-breath. And in this case, in step number three, the body. So perhaps some of you notice the difference of the how we experience that narrow focus of just being very focused on the breath. And then how do you experience it when you open it up? Perhaps if we have time later, some of you can tell me how you experience it. For me, I invariably experience it as very pleasant when I open the focus to include the body. Mainly, I think, because for me, focusing on the body has always been very supportive and has been a big source of learning and discoveries. So the attention on the breath and the whole body, I experience it as kind of like a dialogue between the breath and the body. If I can simply be aware of this rhythmic movement of the breath, of the in and out, and its effect on the body, as I mentioned in the guided meditation, the body knows how to let go of the tensions. And that's exactly what we're asked to do in the fourth step. That's what it's meant when it says calming the bodily activity. One trains calming bodily activity. So the image that I have about this calming the body, bodily activity, is, you know, those beanbags that were so fashionable in the 60s and 70s that were filled with the styrofoam little tiny balls. So if you were to pick up a beanbag and then put it on the ground, it takes a little while for all the styrofoam balls to settle down at the body. That's exactly what's happening. At least that's what I envision that it's happening with this body. It settles in such a pleasant way that we don't have any desire anymore to move. It's not like you're telling yourself, don't move, don't move. It's the body says, I'm so content not to move. So there's no antsiness there. It's just a pleasant state of stability, of well-being. Bhikkhunalaya gives an interesting example of these two types of attention that we have in the first tetrad. He says it's like being in a museum in front of a painting. And when we want to look at the details of the painting, we get close, right? And then we can really see the details of the painting. But then when we want to perceive the whole painting, we step back and then we get an idea of the entirety of the painting. And so it is exactly with our experience with these, with the first two steps, we're asked for the details, the narrow focus, the breath only. Then we're asked step back, open up the focus, and we feel the whole body. So this being able to see in detail and the whole complements each other. And so it is with the attention of the narrow focus of the breath and then the wider focus of the whole body. But now let's talk a little bit about why is it so difficult to keep our minds on the breath? And to start the meditation with that, it can be really humbling because usually at the beginning, it's when our minds are more jumpy, right? And that and we are asked to have this very narrow, very precise focus. I like very much that Bhikkhunalaya talks about the feeling tone of the breath as insipid. So it's like flavorless jello. So the feeling tone of the breath, we can say, is neutral, right? We have three flavors of the feeling tone: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And I think for the breath, I think most of us would agree that if we're not sick and everything is kind of normal, that it's pretty much neutral. So what is our habitual response to neutral feeling tone? We ignore. We distract ourselves. We turn to something much more interesting, more charged, like fantasies or like planning, or even worrying can be more interesting for us. So herein lies the challenge. How can we keep that mind on the breath when it is so subtle, so neutral? We will learn that the more agitated the mind, the less it will be able to stay on something as subtle and neutral as the breath. But the opposite is also true, right? When the mind begins to quiet down, it's so rewarding that we actually can stay on something as subtle, because then they tune each other. Mind tunes breath and breath tunes mind. So we've arrived at the end of the first tetrad. Where are we at the end of the first tetrad? So as we said, you know, bringing back the image of the beanbag, there's a sense of stability, of rootedness, of effortlessness, and all of this is pleasant. Bhikkhunalaya offers the image for this first tetrad of a condor that flies way up and catches the current of the wind. And once it catches the current of the wind, it doesn't need to move its wings anymore. It is just carried by the wind current. And this image functions very well to bring us into the next tetrad, the feeling tone. And now let me put, copy and paste the second tetrad, put it in the chat. I think it worked well with the first one.
Andrea, so let me just check. Can everyone see what she's putting in the chat? Yeah, okay.
Great, thanks for checking, Brigitte. Good. So there you have the first, the second tetrad. So here we're dealing with feeling tone. And as you see here, one trains experiencing joy, I shall breathe in. And then number two, one trains experiencing happiness, I shall breathe in, I shall breathe out. So joy and happiness. So here, while being mindful of the in-breath and out-breath, we incline the mind towards joy and then happiness. The first tetrad instructions, you might agree that they're quite common, and most of us, I think, are familiar with it. However, this part, and this is as far as we're going to go, we're only going to go to this, to step number six, to the happiness. This part is often left out. And I've asked myself, yeah, why is it that it's very common to talk about the first four, but not so much, maybe sometimes you've heard it, but not so much about the joy and the happiness? And my sense is that it's because it's very common not to be able to connect with joy. Mostly because we have not arrived really at the calming of the body, and therefore we are not enjoying just the simplicity of the being in the present moment. Something else that gets in the way is that many of us have grandiose ideas of what this joy should be. And we are dissatisfied with just mild pleasantness. However, any sense of pleasantness, as insignificant as it might be, can be very helpful and onward leading. Just taking note of this little bit of pleasantness can make it grow. Thich Nhat Hanh says, there is no way to happiness. Happiness is the way. So I like to think that it's also a matter of practice of inclining the mind towards the joy. And also, you know, we have to be very this practice is very honest, which I love about this aspect I really love about the practice. Many times I can't access joy, and that's okay. It's not accessible sometimes. And so what do we do? Well, then we can just incline the mind towards the joy. May this mind heart be able to experience joy. We can also just practice contentment with things as they are. That's already very good. Something that helps me when I'm not, also when I'm not being able to connect with joy, is while I'm meditating, I sometimes imagine that I am about to smile. I don't actually smile, but that I am about to smile. And something shifts. Try it and notice what changes. So we don't need to be fake or tacky with a false smile pasted on our face, but just be like a plant that turns towards the light. And another thing that we can do when we just realize joy is just not accessible is that we just go back and back to the first tetrad. Because if we are not touching into joy, most likely is the body hasn't been able to go, ah. Because the moment the body goes, ah, then it's natural to feel even a little bit of well-being or contentment. So just very briefly, we can also support the cultivation of joy off the cushion. We do that by establishing a very firm foundations of ethics in our life and committing to a life that is as much as possible harmless. And it's hard, I know it's hard. I've just had an ant infestation in my study and it's been very hard. But we have this intention to be harmless, to be blameless, and to be free of guilt. And also, as we mentioned in our in our meditation, in the preparatory or the preliminary part, make sure that when we set our intention, that it's not only to benefit ourselves, but all beings. So this altruistic dimension is a way to give us happiness, to give us joy. So the last bit that I want to mention is, what kind of joy are we dealing with when we arrive at the fifth step? This is the unworldly joy. This is what we called an unworldly joy. It's unworldly, and this is important because it doesn't depend on anything, on anything outside, on certain worldly conditions. I don't have to have gotten the job I wanted or the partner I wanted. This is a joy that comes from within, from being aware of what's in the present moment and embracing the whole experience, even if there is some discomfort at the moment. Some of you might know, this is quite lovely, that the Buddha said, this unworldly happiness is one we don't need to fear. This kind of happiness is onward leading. It works like the wind that propels a sailboat forward. It inspires us to continue making effort in our practice, on and off the cushion. And to finish, I'll just read a very short segment of Ajahn Mun, The Ballad of Liberation. In this one deals with the body. So think about the first tetrad and the breath. It's all about the body, how important it is in our practice. Once there was a man who loved himself and feared distress. He wanted happiness beyond the reach of danger. And so he wandered endlessly. Wherever people said that happiness was found, he longed to go. But wandering took a long, long time. He was the sort of man who loved himself and really dreaded death. He truly wanted release from aging and mortality. Then one day he came to know the truth. Abandoning the cause of suffering, compounded things, he found a cave of wonders, of endless happiness, that is, the body. As he gazed through the cave of wonders, his suffering was destroyed, his fears appeased. He gazed and gazed around the mountainside, experiencing unbounded peace. Let's close our eyes for a few seconds.